It is currently 6:15 on this Tuesday morning, January 6th, or as it's otherwise known, King's Day. We officially open up Mardi Gras season today, with carnival season, if you will, with the selling of king cakes. Not that you couldn't get them beforehand. It seems like the king cake window has increased every year. It seems to get wider and wider and wider, which is fine. I love king cakes. There's no problem with that. Our taking it to the text question is asking you, you can have any type of king cake you want from anywhere. You can even create your own if you want. Your imagination, your taste buds, the only boundary. So, with that in mind, what kind of king cake are you having? What are you picking? 504-260-1870. My favorite involved Eggs Benedict. It was more savory than sweet, and I'll tell you about it after the news. Right now, though, we're joined by Patrick Penfield, our friend, professor of supply chain practice at Syracuse University. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good, Tommy. How are you?
I'm okay. Happy New Year to you.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you, Tommy, your listeners.
Do you know what the limit is on New Year's? At what point do you stop saying Happy New Year?
I'm going to say probably in 2 more weeks.
2 more weeks. All right. So we have until mid-January to get all the Happy New Year's out of the way. So I'm looking at a story here from CNN that says a lot of our clients really didn't want to pass the costs of tariffs on, but now they're really having to. And this is the principal at Peacock Tariff Consulting, which surprised me that there is actually a tariff consulting company, but there is. Is this something new? I'm not talking about Peacock specifically, but has this whole tariff thing kind of generated a cottage industry in a way where people didn't really care about tariffs before, where all of a sudden it's like, whoa, hang on here. What's going on?
Oh, absolutely, Tommy. I mean, I think everybody, every business was looking at ways to try to minimize the impact of tariffs. And so a lot of times if you're a consultant, you know, that's one of the things that you can, you know, lend your expertise to in order to get paid. And so, yeah, it's huge business right now, you know, until this subsides.
So when we talk about tariffs in 2025, you know, it's on, it's off, it's off, it's on, it's on, it's off. I don't know who got tariffed for what. How much did the U.S. Treasury collect, and from whom did they collect it?
Yeah, I want to say it was probably close to over $170 billion, and most of that was collected from businesses, you know, so folks that were importing goods here into the United States. And so they collected it from them, and then they, in turn, usually pass that cost on along to the consumers.
So bottom line is they paid it out of their pocket to the U.S. Treasury. It's a tax is what it is. And for the most part, they did pass that along to consumers or not. And what part does that play in rising prices?
Yeah, I think for the most part, most of that was passed on to consumers. And so that's the you know, the whole reason why you see rising prices is just because, again, it's an added cost. And so you've got two choices. Either you pass it on to the consumer or you absorb it and you make less money. So most businesses passed along that, you know, the tariff bump.
So who is being tariffed right now? And from the consumer's standpoint, what goods is it that we would buy, or are they that we would buy that would get our attention? Where it's like, for example, let me give you my towel index at Walmart. Okay, there was a towel at Walmart, and for whatever reason, my kid got married, and I was jokingly bought them some towels as a gift from Walmart. Right, and they were $2 each. And it was a nice towel. There's nothing wrong with the towel. But then I saw this year the same exact towel was now double the price. And I'm wondering, well, there could be a lot of reasons behind this. Could it have been an introductory thing at the beginning where they were trying to get me hooked on the towel, or at least expose me to the towel? Or could it be manufacturing costs have gone up? Or is this a direct result of tariffs? And there's no doubt that this was made in China. So when it comes to textiles in China and tariffs, tell me about my Walmart towels, Patrick.
Yeah, so a lot of times, Tommy, when you're Walmart is like one of the largest importers of goods from China, and just because of, you know, the cost of buying from China is so low. But when tariffs hit, you know, Walmart in turn had to raise prices. And so sometimes you'll see this with Walmart. They'll have what are called loss leaders bring you into the store, try to get you hooked on something or buy something, and then, you know, their thinking is that you'll buy other stuff, which, you know, they've raised prices on. So, you know, that's kind of the whole Walmart approach. So I think for the most part, that's kind of what we've been seeing. You know, if your listeners, you know, what they've probably been, seeing from a price standpoint, coffee's gone up 18% 2025, beef 14%. You know, the interesting thing, Tommy, and this would shock me, was silver. Silver prices went up 147% in 2025, which is just crazy. And a lot of that is because, you know, China controls a lot of the silver industry.
So when it comes to, and I'm not, you know, stuck on this towel or anything, Patrick, but when it comes to doubling the price, would there be enough tariffs in place to justify doubling the price on any item? I know it's hard for you to tell about this one item. There's no way you could do a micro study on that, but I'm just wondering, generally speaking, would the tariff have caused the price to double or not?
No, it shouldn't have. And I think for the most part, that's probably what you saw, Tom, is they got you in there, they sold it at a low price in the beginning, and then they raised the price.
Still a good towel at $4, I'll tell you that. 6:21 more when we come back. Traffic now, WWL. All right, 6:27, couple of minutes left. Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Patrick Penfield, our guest professor of supply chain practice at Syracuse. So if you were to be writing the story of tariffs for 2025, what would the story be as far as the effect it has had on consumers and prices?
Yeah, I think overall prices went up because of tariffs, and I think consumers paid more. So I would think the tariff impact was anywhere probably from 3 to 5%, you know, as far as consumers buying things. I think that's probably what they saw. So unfortunately, that's what happens with tariffs. You know, prices go up.
So what about the other side of it in terms of supply chain? Because the whole idea behind tariffs was to create American investment or American manufacturing, correct?
Yeah, you're correct, Tommy. And I think we're seeing some of that, but we haven't seen it, you know, full scale yet. So that's the problem, you know, when you're building a factory, you know, it takes years. And so, you know, we're not seeing the job creation that we thought we were going to see right away, or that President Trump thought he was going to see right away. It's going to take some time. And so, again, that's the big issue.
And where does the Supreme Court and their decision weigh into all of this?
Yeah, it hasn't been decided yet. So I think this month is when that decision hopefully will be made. So if the Supreme Court says that it was unlawful for President Trump to enact those tariffs, then, you know, we probably could have chaos. So it'll be interesting to see what happens, you know, to the marketplace, what happens to business. And so from what I understand, also businesses could recover that money if they were charged a tariff. If the Supreme Court finds out that, you know, or decides that it's illegal for the president to enact tariffs.
So, you know, you can look at things one of two ways. There's an acronym, TACO, Trump Always Chickens Out. And I know people that love President Trump are going to get angry at that. I'm just telling you that gained traction on Wall Street for much of the summer. But you can look at it as the president, quote, chickened out, or you can look at it as the threat of the tariffs themselves were enough to accomplish what he was trying to do, right?
Yeah, absolutely, right. So, you know, that's the hope, is that, you know, that by doing what he did, that we'll see, you know, job creation here in the United States.
So what should we look for in 2026 as far as tariffs? Or it all depends on what the president decides to do, I guess, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think hopefully, you know, we'll see a little we won't see as much as we saw in 2025. That would be my hope. And that's just because businesses need some type of, you know, baseline, right? They need to make sure that, hey, they understand what prices are. And so if they do, then that'll be good for businesses. If not, if President Trump decides to enact more tariffs, then it'll cause more chaos.
Have tariffs affected the supply chain at all?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, again, we've seen, you know, companies change over to different countries to get a lower tariff. We've seen people try to produce more in the United States. We've seen an impact in regards to prices going up. So, yeah, it's been had a huge impact on the supply chain.
Thank you, Patrick. I appreciate your time as always. Patrick Penfield, professor of supply chain practice at Syracuse. When we come back, we'll talk to Bill Alexander, CEO of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. Law enforcement deaths in the line of duty dropped by 25% in 2025, which is good news. We'll break down that report. And we'll talk to Scott Vaughn, our friend, founder of Unbranded. Governor Landry declared January Human Trafficking Prevention Month. Scott does some good work about what he does with removing tattoos of people that have been sex trafficked that are marked like a product, speaking of supply chain in a grocery store. 6:30, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Eno's Inn. 6:45, quarter till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Bill Alexander, CEO of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. One death in a line of duty is too many, but at least there is some positive news as it relates to the report from 2025. Good morning, Bill. How are you?
Tommy, I'm great. How are you this morning?
I'm okay, sir. Happy New Year to you. Tell me about the report from 2025 as far as law enforcement officers that were killed in the line of duty and what it says.
Well, you're absolutely right. We don't like to say the words good news when we're reporting even a single police officer having died. But this is certainly a very encouraging report. It shows that in 2025, 111 men and women died in the line of duty. That's a 25% drop compared to last year when we had 148. So there, again, not necessarily good news, but certainly very encouraging. All of the major categories which we track, which include deaths by gunfire, traffic, and other, which includes medical events, they're all down year over year.
Has there been any movement in categories of or distinguishable where, say, I know COVID was particularly a terrible time for law enforcement officers and deaths in the line of duty, but has there been any movement within those subsets of traffic stops as opposed to this, as opposed to that?
Well, again, they're all down. The traffic stops, you know, I really do feel like to some degree the decades-long push from law enforcement to help educate and encourage other motorists to be aware of police officers out on the roadway and try to give them time and space. As you well know, localities all across the country have passed move-over laws or something equivalent. So to some degree, the drop in traffic-related fatalities, I hope, is a product of that long push of helping to encourage people to slow down and give officers time and space. The firearms fatalities, while it is down about 15% year over year, our friends and partners over at the FOP track the number of police officers who have been shot in any given year. So that means shot, but not necessarily fatally shot. And those numbers are still trending along where they were last year. So, you know, to some degree, I think these firearms fatalities are down by virtue of lots of police officers getting more advanced medical care, carrying things like tactical emergency care kits with like tourniquets and blood stop loss products. So I think to some degree, the advancing medical care and the advancing medical care just at hospitals in general is helping to save lives that we might have otherwise lost in previous years. And then the other category, much as you mentioned, we no longer count any COVID deaths. And so that had been a very, very big category in years past. And that's obviously way, way down this year.
What is the most dangerous thing when it comes to fatalities for police officers as according to this study?
You know, I think it highlights an area that has always been dangerous, and that is domestic disputes. Responding to a call where emotions are oftentimes very heightened, very raw. Both parties are engaged in a very emotional way that oftentimes leads them to behaviors that they might not normally do. You know, I've been on the scenes before where, say, a wife is adamant that she wants her husband locked up. And no sooner do you have the husband in handcuffs than the wife, you know, all of a sudden decides she doesn't want her husband locked up and begins to get violent. So domestics, you just never know what you're walking into. And those can and are oftentimes are very dangerous. Another subset of calls are going to places where the officer is trying to serve a warrant or otherwise, say, snatch someone. It's not uncommon that those people do not want to go with law enforcement and not infrequently act violently in an attempt to get away. So those are also equally very dangerous situations.
I've got friends that are law enforcement officers, and I know to a person, both men and women, they'll tell me that a domestic call is tough because all of a sudden you think that you're helping A and B get into it. So you think you're helping A, then all of a sudden A says, well, wait, what are you doing to B? Why are you doing that to B? And then before you know it, you got a mess on your hands and somebody's getting
there. You're absolutely right. Yep. Very common.
Where can people find out more about this, Bill?
They can go to our website. It's NLEOMF.org, NLEOMF.org. We are a nonprofit and we exist entirely on donations. So if anyone feels value in what we're doing in terms of honoring the Our Fallen Heroes and trying to tell their story, I hope they might support us.
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate your time as always. And it's, again, hard to say good news. You don't want to say that, but at least a positive indicator. How about that?
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Tommy. Thank you for helping us to tell this very important story.
You bet. God bless the men and women who wear the badge. I wouldn't do it. God bless those that choose to do it. Bill Alexander, CEO of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. We'll talk about sex trafficking and what Scott Vaughn is doing to help victims that have been sex trafficked when we come back. 6:50, 10 till 7. It's time for traffic on WWL. 6:55, 5 till 7. Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by our friend Scott Vaughn. founder of Unbranded. Happy New Year, Scott. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Tommy. Happy New Year to you.
I am so glad to have you on with us, and I'm happy that Governor Landry declared January Human Trafficking Prevention Month in Louisiana. This is something that's not pretty. Nobody wants to talk about it, but it does affect an awful lot of people. And what you do, you and your organization, corrects an awful thing that is in addition to all of the trauma and all of the things that go along with human trafficking. What you do to remove the tattoo, the barcode, whatever it is, I think is outstanding. Let's start there. Scott, tell people what Unbranded is and what it is that you all do.
Well, we're a nonprofit organization that provides tattoo removal free of charge to survivors of sex trafficking that have been branded by their sex trafficker. And really no different than a rancher brands his livestock. That's what a sex trafficker does, so that he is claiming ownership of a human being, and that if that boy or girl is seen in public by other sex traffickers, they know who that boy or girl belongs to, which sex trafficker they belong to. So really no different than a rancher brands his livestock.
And what is so important when it comes to the healing process of this is, just as people get a tattoo to remind them of something notable or something that they want to commemorate, it's kind of hard to move on from the trauma when you are constantly staring down or looking in the mirror at something that has been forcibly placed on your body by those that were basically keeping you as a slave.
That's exactly true, Tommy. It's hard for these boys and girls to go through the rehabilitation process, the physical rehabilitation process, having that constant reminder on their skin. So what we do is very critical in the healing process to help them work through and eliminate all the sexual and physical and mental abuse that they've gone through from that sex trafficker that has claimed ownership of their body.
What is the youngest victim that you've treated, Scott?
Well, the youngest.
I don't want you to violate any confidence or anything, but just so people understand.
No, the youngest that I've treated is about 21 years old, but those that I've treated at that age had been sex trafficked as young as 5 years old by a family member. And a family member will do that to help generate money to support their habit, whether it be drug or alcohol. And it's kind of sickening to say, but that's where it happens a lot. A family member sex trafficking their own child.
Tell me how people can get involved. First of all, what is involved in it, in that what you do? I know it's hard for people to come to you because you're talking about a subset of individuals here that have been through a lot, and they have to have the means to get to wherever you are. Do you go to them? Mm-hmm. What happens? Scott, take me through that process, please.
They come to our clinic in Metairie, but they are referred to us by different organizations that they're currently going through a rehabilitation program with, like the New Orleans Mission, the Eden House, the Sparrow Foundation, Empower 225. Those organizations will reach out to us when that boy or girl is ready to go through the process of having their branding removed, have their tattoos removed. And then that organization will set up the patient's appointment with us. They'll come in, we'll do a brief little evaluation process, and then we'll start the tattoo removal. And it usually takes anywhere from 3 to 6 treatments, and we can have it completely gone like there was nothing there, like a new canvas.
How big of a problem is sex trafficking for people that don't understand?
Oh, it's a huge problem. You know, a lot of people don't realize that actually goes on, but unfortunately it does. New Orleans and Baton Rouge are hot spots. But not only does it happen in big cities, it happens in small towns as well. I live in Ponchatoula, even though the office is in Metairie, and I treat survivors of sex trafficking that are here in Ponchatoula, that are here in Hammond, that are from Kentwood. So it happens in small towns just as much as it happens in big towns.
If people want to get involved, want to help you out, how do they do it, Scott?
Please visit unbranded.org, because we're a 501c3 nonprofit, and we do this free of charge. So we rely on contributions and donations from individuals and businesses to help us offset the cost to provide this service free of charge.
Scott's a former SEC official, and his organization has the approval of the NFL officials, so that goes to show you they're totally legit. Thank you, Scott.
Yes. Thank you.
7:15, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Billy Joel here bringing us back from break, echoing what Nicolas Maduro had to say yesterday in court, that he is an innocent man. David Law joins us, E. James Kelly Jr., class of 1965, research professor of law and courtesy professor of politics at the University of Virginia. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
Happy 2026. I'm good. I love Billy Joel, too.
Yeah, good. Happy 2026 to you. So, you know, if you go to Louisiana Revised Statutes or whatever, the criminal code book, it says you can't, and I'm paraphrasing here, you can't break into somebody's house and take their property. If you do, you get arrested, you get indicted, you get charged with criminal trespass, burglary, whatever the statute says. That becomes a lot more complicated when you're talking about plucking a sitting president from a country and a 25-page indictment and proving that criminal case in court, right?
Yeah, but you would be amazed by how little the courts have actually said about this when it comes to the president's power to do something like this. You know, part of the problem here is the way executive power expands over time and is expanded so much since the time of the framers is the executive branch builds on what it's done in the past. So there's this two-step process, right? First, the executive branch asks itself, gee, am I allowed to do this? And then it turns, how does it ask that question? It turns to its own lawyers in the Department of Justice. And so the executive branch lawyers tend to give this answer that favors the executive branch. The answer is, gosh, thanks for asking a whole lot. So, for example, the infamous torture memo, right? That came out of the Department of Justice. And it said,
tell me what that is, David. Refresh our memory, please. The infamous torture memo.
Yeah, the torture memo was, there were lawyers in the Department of Justice who said that it was okay to use practices like waterboarding against so-called enemy combatants who were being held in Guantanamo Bay during the war on terror in the Bush 2 years. So that memo came from the executive branch's own lawyers in the Department of Justice. So first you get a memo like this from your own lawyers that says, yeah, it's okay for you to do this. And then what happens is you would think Congress might say something, right? Like, we can't believe you sent the Delta Force in plus the airborne rangers into Venezuela to grab some guy. Don't you need us to declare war? But it's so rare for Congress to push back hard enough, long enough to get a court ruling on this. Like, look at the current situation, for example, where the Republicans control Congress and the White House, right? So the congressional Republicans are going along with pretty much everything the current administration wants to do. Now, sometimes maybe initially Congress sues, but, you know, here's the problem. Lawsuits take time. They take a lot of time, and elections occur every 2 years. So then the White House changes hands, or Congress changes hands, or both, and the lawsuit gets dropped or settled. So you never get a court ruling. Then the next opinion from the Department of Justice lawyers builds on the previous opinion, right? So this is a pretty good example of that, where you remember 1989, we went into Panama and removed General Manuel Noriega. And the question was, well, did we have the legal authority to do that? That was the president's question. The president turns to his own lawyers, and he had a lawyer in the Office of Legal Counsel, a guy, you may recognize his name, Bill Barr, right? Mm-hmm. So in the first Bush administration, Bush 1, this guy was assistant attorney general working in, you guessed it, the Office of Legal Counsel in the Department of Justice. And he writes this memo that says, yeah, actually, the president can do this. And he says, sure, this is, you know, and let's say it's against international law. Let's say it's against the UN Charter. All that, in theory, applies to the U.S. But then he lays out this two-part argument, right? He says, first, the president has inherent constitutional power to enforce the laws under the Take Care Clause. And that includes the power to enforce criminal laws. And that includes the power to enforce criminal laws, notwithstanding what international law might say, right? So that's the first part of what he says. Then he says the second part is the president also has this inherent protective power to protect federal officials carrying out their jobs. So, for example, the president can use the army to protect federal officials, like an FBI agent doing his or her job. So that means you could send in Delta Force plus the Ranger Division plus an entire Air Force bomber wing to protect an FBI agent serving an arrest warrant against, say, the leader of Panama or, say, the president of Venezuela. So you're left with, so then the executive branch keeps giving itself legal opinions that build on each other, and then Congress never pushes back. So the only people you're left with questioning the legality of this tends to be law professors looking at what the courts have said in the past, what the laws say, and trying to predict what a court would say or should say And, you know, law professors like me might say, gee, it's hard to believe that the framers had this in mind. It's hard to believe the Constitution permits this. It's hard to believe a court would sign off on this. But this court, this Supreme Court, is extremely friendly to claims of presidential power. So even that might not be true. It's quite possible the Supreme Court would sign off on this. So that's how we got in the situation. Unbelievably, there's no clear court answer as to whether the president can do this.
Well, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. So many questions, never enough time. David Law is our guest, a professor of law at Virginia. 7:21 now, traffic, WWL. 7:26, Tommy Tucker, WWL. David Law, our guest, professor of law at Virginia, at the University of Virginia. And we're talking about the Nicolas Maduro thing. And as I said yesterday, what's legal is not always right. What's right is not always legal. And you can't just do stuff. Or then again, maybe you can just do stuff if you're the president. So geopolitical implications aside, is there any legal difference here between the United States deciding to go in and relieve Ping of his duties in China, or the leader of North Korea, or Putin, or pick a country that violates human rights or that deals in drug trafficking? Is there a difference really between what the United States did with Maduro or those other scenarios legally?
That's the problem right there. It's a slippery slope. There isn't necessarily a difference. There really isn't. So let's say the president of France, the prime minister of Canada, goes fishing, right, with some buddies in the U.S. and happens to fish in federal waters without a license. Well, you could, in theory, send an FBI agent in backed by the U.S. Army to bring him here for trial. In theory, you could.
But even beyond that, Maduro didn't come here to fish, right? I mean, he was there in his country and he's accused of a 25-page indictment. So I guess let's talk about that, David. What exactly is he charged with? For example, I saw a weapons charge, and I'm just wondering, with the possession of a machine gun, if he's in his own country, and I'm not defending Nicolas Maduro. I'm talking about the legal part of this. Why would that be against U.S. law?
Yeah, so I'm not a criminal law guy, but there's, I think, four sets of charges. Conspiracy to commit narco trafficking, I think, is one of them. Mm-hmm. Then there's the weapons charges you mentioned. One thing that is pretty well established is just because some other government says that something is lawful doesn't mean that we have to permit it under U.S. law. So that's part of it. The other part of it is, can we regulate the behavior of people in other countries? And the U.S. position is tended to be yes. This gets a little tricky. For me, this is a bit sensitive because I lived in Hong Kong and worked there for years. And, you know, I said a number of things that probably in the eyes of the Chinese government are sedition. And the Chinese government has tried to enforce those laws against critics of the Chinese government in other countries. And so, you know, that does cut both ways. And we're going to try to prosecute people extraterritorially, as they say, for things that they've done against U.S. law in other countries. We shouldn't be shocked when other countries like China try to enforce their laws extraterritorially against people in the United States. So it does cut both ways. That's a problem.
So for people that are big supporters of President Trump, is this different than another country? And look, I understand with the defenses of the United States, it's not likely to happen. But is it different legally than another country saying, you know what, you decided to drop a drone or used a drone to destroy this guy, whatever. We're looking at that as an international war crime, so we're going to sweep in and take you out and bring you back to our country for trial. Legally speaking, is there any difference or not?
So, you know, at the end of the day, to really have the answer, you need a court to answer that question. And again, part of the problem is when the president builds on, you know, well, here's what I did last time. Here's what I did the time before that. And Congress doesn't push back and no one sues or no one can sue or no one will sue and see it all the way through to judicial decision. You never get a court actually weighing in. So, you know, do I think this is legally questionable? I do, but there's no court that actually has said that the president can't do this in very clear terms. We haven't had anything like a court ruling on this.
Thank you, David. Appreciate it. David Law, E. James Kelly Jr., Class of 65, Research Professor of Law and Courtesy Professor in Politics, University of Virginia. We'll talk about the political part of this when we come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. 747, 13 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined now by David Schultz, professor of political science and law at Hamline University. Hey, David, Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, and I hope all is well.
Thank you. From the texts I get here, I can tell you that the people that favor President Trump, right or wrong, think that no matter what, he is totally 100% right with Maduro. Those that hate him or don't like him are completely and totally against it. The truth is probably somewhere in between when it comes to Maduro. Tell me your thoughts as a professor of law and political science about what transpired over the weekend.
Well, what transpired over the weekend raises lots of, I'd say, both legal questions domestically and international law, and a lot of sort of political questions in terms of what's happening. Now, in terms of domestically, if the news accounts are correct, this has been planned for several months. It sounds like, you know, this venture, you know, to get Maduro. And the reason why I mention this is that most people would argue that the Constitution gives the president broad authority to use force to protect the United States if we're attacked. Nobody disputes that. But the Constitution gives the power to Congress to declare war, to finance the military and so forth. And the reason why I mention this is that Congress was largely left in the dark on this. And there's questions regarding whether or not the president actually had the authority to go in and do the kind of operation that he did when we weren't being attacked. So that's one set of legal questions. The other is, under international law, we're not supposed to invade another country's sovereign space. We're not supposed to use force or aggression as a way of resolving disputes. There's legal questions, but now from a political, and I'm going to say a pragmatic point of view, the president has said, you know, we've taken Maduro out, and we're going to, quote, run the country and pump their oil. Well, what does all that mean in terms of governance and in terms of whether or not or how much we're going to get involved in Venezuela's domestic matters? There's stories that are already pointing out the fact that Maduro's vice president has ordered martial law, crackdown. The government still has control of the military. We're not putting the opposition into power. I mean, are we setting up a recipe for civil war and for us to have to send in troops to protect oil interests? And so it just raises all types of politically thorny questions, and it makes me think of what Afghanistan and Iraq all over again.
All right, so politically, does anybody other than those that truly support President Trump or truly oppose him care about any of this at all, or is it all about the price at the pump? And if, for whatever reason, oil prices go down or the price of gasoline goes down, and there's a lot of steps between oil and gasoline, I understand that. But is that the ultimate arbiter of this, that if the price goes down and people are for it, if the price goes up, then they're against it?
It probably will be, I think, at the end of the day, except anybody who thinks that the price is going to go down right away would be by naive. Now, I'm certainly not an oil expert. You probably have people down in your part of the world who know a lot more about refining and stuff like that, you know, than probably you and I do. But it's going to take years to rebuild the oil infrastructure down there. And so I wouldn't expect to see any significant impact on prices, at least in the short term, in terms of what's going to happen. But some are also arguing that at a point where the president is worried about the fact that he has near record low approval ratings, you know, is this kind of a way of diverting some people away from domestic issues, you know, and trying to prop up his ratings? Because we know, you know, Trump wouldn't be the first president to try to use some type of international event as a way of trying to prop up popularity. I mean, it's a very tried and true technique. And so I'm not just accusing Trump, but it's, you know, other presidents have done this too.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We'll go back, talk about what else Congress has to look ahead to and what's on their agenda for 2026, 7:51, 9 till 8, traffic now, WWL. All right, 757, 3 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to David Schultz, professor of law and political science at Hamline University. What else does Congress have on their plate? Well, actually, I shouldn't say what else, because this had nothing to do with Congress, really, did it, the Maduro action?
It had nothing to do, although, again, it probably should have. There should have been some kind of consultation as required under both the War Powers Act and under the Constitution. But for the most part, both Republicans and Democrats seem to have been in the dark regarding what happened.
And for those that are listening right now, hearing nothing but, oh, why are you banging on President Trump, brah? Nobody's banging on President Trump, but the thing you have to understand is that once the executive branch assumes powers, next time it might not be your person doing this, and they may decide to go into wherever and start whatever for whatever reason, and there's nothing you'll be able to do about it. That's all we're saying. Tell me about Congress. What is they're going to be looking at in 2026?
Well, a variety of different things they're going to be looking at. Remember, it's an election year, which means everything is going to be cast over with how they're eyeing what's going to happen in November of 2026. But for example, if I remember correctly, the budget deal that ended the government shutdown, that's going to be expiring in the next few months. And so they're going to have to revisit some of that. I think we're going to have to look at some point along the line here, probably expanding the debt ceiling again. So we've got these as kind of major points. And then, of course, before the 2026 elections, there's going to be the issue of passing the next budget. And I think the most immediate issue right now is the fact that the subsidies for Obamacare have expired, and we're now looking at a lot of pressure on Congress, especially the Republicans, to come up with an alternative health care plan to be able to address the, you know, the affordability of insurance. I would probably put that pretty much at the highest part of the list here, because I think most of your listeners are probably looking at their insurance premiums and saying, my gosh, you know, how am I going to be able to afford this? And so I would put that on kind of the list.
Where does Congress get involved when it comes to funding whatever happens in Venezuela?
They're supposed to be able to, they have appropriations power. They're the ones who are supposed to appropriate the money and spend the money to be able to pay for whatever we're doing down there.
Thank you, David. Appreciate your time. David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University. When we come back, we'll talk to WWL sports director Steve Geller. Take another look back at the Saints season and look ahead to next season. We'll also talk with Barry Keim, who is LSU health climatologist, about why Mardi Gras is so early this year, and it goes to the whole lunar calendar and all of that stuff. Then we'll wrap up the hour by talking to John Fitzmaurice, the instructor of history at UNO, about the cannons that are across from Jackson Square. Cannon, actually, but what about the Washington artillery? We'll take a look at that. Of course, we'll talk to Arthur Hardy, and we'll talk to Judy Ho about keeping New Year's resolutions. A lot coming up. 818 now, joined by Steve Geller, WWL sports director, to look at the Saints 2025 season, look ahead to 2026. How you doing, Steve?
Doing all right, Tommy. Definitely sad that another season's in the books.
Yeah, it went by pretty quick. I'm going to tell you what, we know we have our little poll here where we predict the number of wins and losses, and apparently I nailed it with 6 wins. I wish it had been more than that, but I got to tell you what, and listening to Deuce and Mike Haas on Sunday, and you know, Deuce said, we coming, and he paraphrased Deion Sanders, and I think he's right. I think the Saints are coming in 2026. Give me your thoughts on the season, looking back on it.
Yeah, what a way the team finished. Lots of positives considering how the year started. We know the beginning wasn't the greatest, and it kind of looked like, oh no, we're going to be destined for a top three draft pick after the slow start for this team. But things, once Tyler Shuck was named the starting quarterback, he came in the second half against the Rams game, and then, I mean, he went on to win, you know, 5 games in the 9 starts he made, and you kind of saw a team starting to believe in themselves. The guy that made everyone around him better is what you want from a quarterback. And when Tyler Shuck came in, things definitely start to move better on this offense. The biggest problem, though, a constant issue that's got to be addressed in the offseason, is the slow starts. I don't know how to remedy that, except for maybe, you know, get guys' body clocks working differently. But it was just really amazing to see this year, the first quarter especially, how dismal the Saints were and then later on the game able to come back and pick things up. But playing from behind, we know, isn't the most ideal thing. I'm with you, though. A lot of positives right now. Everyone talks about it. Looks like you've got your quarterback. It sure seems like we've got the coach. Can you continue now hitting on the draft, get those free agents in here that are going to make a difference for this squad? And shoot, we know the NFC South is no dynamite powerhouse right now with the way the Panthers, you know, ended up sneaking in to being the division champs, not just the playoffs. They won the division sneaking in thanks to the Atlanta Falcons beating the Saints in that tiebreaker against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And, man, we saw the Saints, the depleted Saints team, being able to sweep the Carolina Panthers this year. So I would definitely say tons of positive energy going into this offseason. Even though it was a 6-10 season, yeah, there's still a lot to like. A 6-11 season, I should say.
Let's talk about some of the free agents. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. 8:21 more with Steve Geller. When we come back, you heard the sports report from Steve about Cam Jordan, and I can't imagine him putting anybody else's uniform on. I hope they manage to work it out. We'll talk about DeMario Davis, some of the other guys that are getting a little bit older, and what the next year, what next year's team is likely to look like. And actually, this year's team at the end didn't look anything like it did at the beginning when you look at receiver, et cetera. 8:22 traffic now, WWL. Whoopsie, 8:26, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Steve Geller, WWL sports director, talking about the Saints 2025, looking ahead to 2026. Give me some names of some institutions, some Saints institutions that may or may not be on the field in 2026 for the black and gold.
Yeah, I think the biggest talked about names right now, Tommy, for the Saints coming back for next year, being the big question marks because of age. The DeMario Davis linebacker, the stud that seems to never age, though. Another guy, too, Cam Jordan, the just Mr. Reliable, always available. And Taysom Hill, we saw him after the home finale, really emotional in that post-game speech. And it kind of felt like, oh, no, this is the end for him. Out of those three, I don't know if Taysom Hill is coming back to football, much less the Saints. He hasn't made any comments, unlike DeMario Davis and Cam Jordan, who said, heck yeah, they're ready to play next year, and they hope that they're back in black and gold. But, yeah, we're going to see how things work out. Obviously, the price is going to be the big deal for these veteran guys.
Do you see, you know, I mean, Cam, look, it's easy to say, it's easy to be frivolous with somebody else's money, right? But do you see Cam?
Right, exactly.
Do you see Cam going anywhere else?
It's hard to envision it, Tommy. He's just such a stud when it comes to on the field. We saw a resurgence. He led the team in sacks this season with 10.5. And it's not just that. I love his makeup, his mentality, what he stands for.
Roots in the community,
too. Yep. What was that?
I said roots in the community. That's exactly what you said.
Yeah, every single Tuesday, this guy's going to a school during the season, making impressions on the youth in the city, and just the amount of work he does. He just seems like the very definition to me of talent and a guy for the community that every franchise wishes they had. And DeMario Davis the same way. So I'm very biased too. And like you said, it's easy for me to spend the Saints money. I would definitely keep both guys around since they are still performing at that high level. DeMario led the team in tackles, and Cam Jordan just led the team in sacks.
So when it comes to draft, who do you think the Saints would be looking at in the draft?
Yeah, for me, I'm definitely looking at more of the trenches or at wide receiver. I know a lot of folks have fallen in love with the running.
Yeah,
running back Jeremiah Love, everybody keeps talking about as a potential pick for them at 8th overall. I don't want to take a running back that early, but that's just me. I want to build more, either another pass rusher. I know it's not going to be the sexiest thing for Saints fans. The offensive line, especially the interior, needs so much help. And then wide receiver, I know, you know, Chris Olave, and we saw some things from Devon Valet, but I just feel like you could use that bigger, tight body, physical receiver to pair up with this Saints offense and give Tyler Shuck as many targets as possible, please.
I never thought I'd be referring to an NFL coach as a young man, but that young man, Kellen Moore, he's only 37. He showed me something this season as far as surrendering the results to the process.
Yeah, and man, Tommy, he is an all-pro in addressing the media. He doesn't say much, and he's just knows what to do for his team. son of a coach and hoping he can continue to build this roster into that NFC South winner next season.
Born on the 5th of July in, you ready for this, 1988.
Oof.
Wow. Yeah, oof is right. Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it as always. Steve Geller, WWL Sports Director. We'll talk to John Fitzmaurice about the Washington Artillery. We pass by it every time in Jackson Square. Maybe you know what it is, maybe you don't, but we'll talk about it when we return. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. 8:46, 14 till 9. Hang on to yourselves here. Well, hang on to you, whatever, your seats, because we're going to learn something here. I saw the cannon in Washington, in Jackson Square, the Washington Artillery, and got me to wondering, what the hell's all that about? And I've passed it Lord knows how many times. John Fitzmaurice joins us, an instructor of history at UNO. Good morning, John. How are you? Happy New Year.
Good morning and Happy New Year to you, Tommy.
There are things all over the city that we walk past every day, and we have no earthly idea the history behind them. True?
Not just true, but very, very true.
Very, very true. Two verys. Good. Let's talk about the 141st Field Artillery Regiment, or the Washington Artillery. Tell me the story behind that.
Well, every colony that was established either by England or France or Spain and so forth almost immediately had a militia in order to defend itself against attacks, either through native tribes or against one of the other European powers. And Louisiana was no exception. And so the Washington Artillery traces its origins back to the days of Bienville and Perrier, and then the Spanish colonization of Louisiana, as well, administration of Louisiana as well. Now, the Washington Artillery was actually founded officially on September the 7th, 1838. But like I said, the origins go way back to colonial Louisiana.
Does it still exist, or is the only remnant the cannon?
Oh, no, no. It is still very much in existence. It is headquartered today at Jackson Barracks. It's called now today the 256th Infantry Combat Team Fire Battalion, and it's part of the Louisiana National Guard. Its current commander is Major Michael Lacoste.
Tell me about the history of defending, I guess, the city and the country of the field artillery, the Washington Artillery.
Well, after the Louisiana Purchase in 1803, Louisiana, of course, needed to reconstitute a militia on the American model. And so they took the old French and Spanish militia battalions, and they put it together as an artillery battalion. And then, of course, after 1815, the militia then begins to choose the name George Washington as its title for patriotic fervor from, the 1815 to the 1830s. But, of course, many in the artillery at the time said Washington was named after their artillery, not their artillery after Washington.
Tell me how the tiger came to be the mascot.
Well, over time, Louisiana's artillery and its militia was so well trained that even Robert E. Lee at the Battle of First Manassas said that Louisianians fought for him like tigers, and the name stuck. And hence, we have a small football team up in Baton Rouge that now bears that moniker as well.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. We're talking about the Washington Artillery with John Fitzmaurice, instructor of history at my alma mater, I'm proud to say, UNO. 8:50, 10 till 9, traffic now, WWL. 8:55, 5 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL. We like to take a varied approach here in the morning, and we're going to try to spend some time this year talking about some things that we walk past every day, and we take them for granted. And as John Fitzmaurice, instructor of history at my alma mater, UNO, said, it happens very, very often where we don't know what the heck it is, and we just take it for granted. So the 101st Field Artillery Regiment, the Washington Artillery, founded in 1838, most recent action, as I understand it, was in 2021, I think it is, or 2020 to 2021. It deployed to Iraq and Syria as part of the 256th Infantry Brigade in support of Operation Inherent Resolve. How would the makeup of the soldiers differ from 1838 to today's soldier in terms of?
Good. It's a far more professional organization now than it was back then. And this is not to denigrate the men who served in the Washington Artillery back in 1838, but it was more of a sort of an elite gentleman's club that was established. And they were very fiercely independent and wanted to stay that way. And they resisted many attempts to, integrate them further into the Army over time.
So were they paramilitary, John, or part of the military?
I would not call them paramilitary because they never operated outside of the military structure. They were always a part of the military structure, but they always maintained their independence from the military to a certain degree. Not in the sense that they would go where they were told, they would fight when they were told, but they maintained a sense of autonomy with it.
Were these people of means?
Yes, they were the social elites of New Orleans and Louisiana. In fact, it became a sort of a sign of status that I was a member of the Washington Artillery back in the day. And that goes all the way back to Captain James Walton, who's considered the father of the Washington Artillery. Mm-hmm. He wasn't the first commander of the Washington Artillery, but he's the one that began making it into a true fighting force to be reckoned with.
So when it comes to training, obviously there's a different standard for training now than there was then. Did they go about training themselves, or was it an art form unto itself because they were of means?
It was sort of a combination of both, in that they were men of means, and so they used their own resources oftentimes to do that, but they did submit to military training from time to time. They were very particular about choosing their own commanders, but at a certain point they accepted the fact that they needed to accept an outside commander from the military to stay within. And this is how, for instance, Stonewall Jackson's grandson became commander of the Washington Artillery in the early 20th century.
What would their greatest accomplishment be if you had, as a historian, to align one or assign one to the Washington Artillery?
I think that they set the standard for the development of state militias along a very professional line. They were very strong on professional development, military development as well. And I think that they were very key and integral also during the Second World War, when Louisiana's maneuvers took place in Western Louisiana.
Well, Louisiana's what took place? I want to hear that part, John.
The Louisiana maneuvers, which were the military exercises that took place in Western Louisiana prior to and during the Second World War, because Western Louisiana was so wide open that the tank commanders were able to use that as a training ground. This is why we have Fort Polk. And then after that, the Washington Artillery took part in that as well. And they set the standard for professional training.
Thank you, John. I appreciate the information as always. We're going to do that this year, man. We're going to educate ourselves about all the stuff that surrounds us. We'll be back talking to Arthur Hardy on WWL. Thank you. And 909 quickly to Arthur Hardy, founder of the Mardi Gras Guide. How you doing, Arthur Hardy?
Happy King's Day. We got 6 weeks to party, brother.
Man, I'm going to tell you what. I was looking at that. The earliest it can be is February 3rd, I think, right?
Right. And the latest is March 9th.
And it's February 17th this year, which means it's 2 weeks longer than the shortest could be. What is it? Traditionally speaking, how does that manifest itself throughout Mardi Gras seasons when it's a shorter period? Is there a marked difference that you've noticed, Arthur?
No, not really, and it does vary from year to year. But February 17th is the most popular day for Fat Tuesday. It's happened 9 times on that day since 1857.
Really?
When we really started parades, yeah. Huh. And normally the weather's good. I mean, in the 60s, no rain, so I'm hoping that trend holds up for at least another year.
Let's talk about the 40 Funny Fellows. How did that organization get started? And why not 50? Why not 38?
Well, it's, it's a reincarnation of a group that started in 1878 and paraded behind or in front of wrecks off and on through the 1890s. And it's actually more than 40, but they are funny and they're not all fellows, but they just borrowed that name. And it's, you know, they call themselves the Heralds of Carnival.
Tell me what
beginning of carnival season.
Tell me what that parade is like for people that don't know, because I was under the impression that they just rode a streetcar. Is that true or not?
Well, no, that's the public part. They have a private ball. Mm-hmm. But I rode with them a couple of times in the last 5 years, and I was amazed at how many people line up with lawn chairs and tables along the route. I mean, it takes about 8 seconds for the streetcar to pass, but it's become a real, real event. And tremendous crowds that you just would be really surprised. But people are so ready for Mardi Gras and the season. And, you know, officially kicks off today. First day you legally are supposed to have king cake. And I haven't had my first taste yet, but I'm on my way to Mardi Gras World where the mayor kicks off Carnival with a celebration. And I promise you I'll eat king cake there.
The mayor, you said?
Yes. This is a tradition going back, you know, several decades, where it's the official opening of the carnival season. So most of the carnival organizations are represented there. Zulu does a second line, and it's not open to the public. It's for carnival participants and media.
Oh, it's
only
for royalty only. Let's say it, Arthur. Let's just say it.
Oh, no. Hey, I'm there. It can't be too royal, right?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if we can talk about what's coming up or not. I don't know if anything's embargoed or not. Can we talk about what's...
Oh, no. Not at all. I'm happy to be the Grand Marshal, perhaps one of two, we're not sure yet, of the Endymion Parade this year, which is just going to be a thrill. I've never ridden in a parade other than Rex, which is a big other than. I mean, I'm very
sure.
Happy about that. But to be on my own float with my name on it and have doubloons and all, gee, it's a great way to go out.
Your likeness on the float, Arthur, or not? Do you know?
Well, I don't know. I know my name will be on it, but I'll be on it, and I'll have doubloons and cups with my likeness on it. So I'm really, really excited about it, Tommy.
One of my bucket list items, and I'm approaching like the second decade of doing this, right? So,
mm-hmm.
well, more though. I mean, like getting the second decade under my belt. I guess it'd be more appropriate to say approaching the third decade of doing this. But one thing that I always wanted to do was to have either my name or my likeness. And I was the Grand Marshal of Tux. I'm not talking about that.
Yep.
I'm talking
yep.
about actually on a float. You know what mm-hmm. I'm saying? To have your face
yeah.
on a float.
Yeah.
Is that a new, I would imagine, a uniquely New Orleans thing, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And of course, there's some people who don't want their likenesses on the float. If, mm-hmm. if the parade happens to be in chaos or perhaps muses or detente, because normally it's a satirical representation.
See, I don't
and
care.
Sometimes not,
I don't
not
care. It can be Tommy Tucker sucks. It can be Tommy Sucker, if that's what they want to do. So long as they put my, if they have my big old ugly face on the head of a float, that's all I'm looking for.
Well, it may happen.
Well, probably too late now. What else, Arthur, is coming up for you?
Well, I'm just expecting a really good season. The magazine is really selling well. It's our biggest issue ever. It's our 50th anniversary, and we've got a double fold on the front cover where we have depicted all 49 past issues of the Mardi Gras Guide, and that's kind of cool. And we also have a book out about the last 50 years that I've covered Carnival. So pretty excited about those things. It looks like it's going to be a regular Mardi Gras season. And after all the humbug we've had the last few years, you know, regular will be just fine, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I don't know if – I don't know what I don't know. So here's what I'm going to do. Tim, mm-hmm. are we ready to go here? We're going to play a little filler music here. What better filler music on King's Day than this? You see, now that's the kind of thing – that's the kind of thing that will get me on a float. So, Arthur, with that being said, let's talk about your TV special that's coming up or what's happening on Channel 12 for you.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this, too. Dennis Waltzman produced a 30-minute documentary on my career in the Mardi Gras business. It's not finished being edited yet, but I've seen some of the rough cuts, and not surprisingly, it's flattering. I guess you wouldn't do a documentary and say, this guy's trash, but... really tells my life story, basically, and really proud about that. It's going to premiere on January 22nd on WIS, and it'll be aired several times, and also on their PBS channel and YouTube and all. And I can't wait to see the finished version, but it probably makes me look better than I really am. But I don't want them to cut any of the good stuff out, so there.
What are you hearing from captains, et cetera, about membership, about tariffs and throws or anything else, or any financial challenges, et cetera?
Nobody's panicked. You know, I think maybe throw orders may be down a couple of percentage points, but I don't think anybody in the street's going to notice it. I don't think Mardi Gras has ever been healthier. Mardi Gras seems like it's just bulletproof when it comes to so many things. You know, we do this and we do it even when we can't afford it and spend money maybe we don't have, but who cares? It's Mardi Gras, right?
Well, that's America, really.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Mardi Gras 2026 as opposed to Mardi Gras 1976, for which I presume you were around. You were a child, right? A young child.
No, in 76, I was 30 years old.
Let's just go with young child.
Okay.
What is a difference that you see that you think is positive that you could not have seen coming? Because the next question is going to be, look 50 years down the line and where are we going to be?
Yeah. It's impossible to look in the future and see what's, you know, where it's going to go. Hopefully it's still here. But in terms of looking backwards,
hopefully it's still here.
Yeah, well, I mean, who knows? Hopefully civilization's still here.
No, that's true.
I can't see into the future.
Yeah,
but
tomorrow's not guaranteed.
Yeah, that's it. But I think the biggest change is the diversity. How many more opportunities, how many more sections or sectors of society have a chance to participate now? That's been the biggest growth, particularly in female crews. They've kind of taken over. The biggest crews are now populated by females. It's changed, and it's been a good change. It's just so much more democratic now than it was. And I think it's a great thing, a tremendous improvement.
Do you think it'll ever get back to having neighborhood parades again, like Gretna or Algiers? Or, you know, Algiers still has, and I'm talking no disrespect at all. But to those kind of things where, I don't know if you want to call it regional, where I think St. Bernard has one parade, right?
Yeah, that's correct. No, I don't. Logistically, it's just, it's so expensive to provide services for parades that a standardized route makes complete sense. Now, with that, we've lost a lot. You know, I love the neighborhood parades, but to think they'll come back, it's not going to happen.
In the traditional sense, but there are some this weekend, right, that are non-traditional, in addition, starting with tonight, and then take us through the weekend, if you can, Arthur.
Yeah, well, I mean, in Covington, we've got the St. John Fools Saturday night, and I'm driving right now, so I don't have my schedule.
That's all right. Well, I'm looking at Société des Champs-Élysées at 7:30 tonight. What is that?
Yep, that's a streetcar parade on Brampart to Elysian Fields, and then the Funky Uptown crew tonight follows Funny 40 Fellows. Then the big Joan of Arc parade, which I'm going to see tonight for the first time in about 10 years. Mm-hmm. Different route, starts at 7:30. That's become a really popular and beautifully artistic parade on foot, you know, through the French Quarter. And so there's a lot going on. And starting off, with the mayor's kickoff party in less than an hour at Mardi Gras World, and that's where I'm headed as we speak.
And Saturday in Covington, Fools of Misrule, what is that about?
Yeah, it's a walking parade, a whole lot of fun, a little bit of drinking. They have special doubloons they throw, they have flambeau. I've had the chance to be with them on several occasions, and it's really neat in downtown Covington.
One thing, and then there's Mandy King's Day in Mandeville at 3
o'clock.
Yeah,
that's the Mandy Milkshakers. That's one of my favorite groups. Did a couple of features with them on Fox 8, and just a fun-loving bunch. And who says you can't be middle-aged and still be in a parade and have a good time?
It would seem like one thing that is different and getting bigger and bigger each year on Mardi Gras Day is Treme and those different kind of gatherings. Talk about that real quick before I let you go, please.
Yeah, well, I never get down there because I'm committed elsewhere, but it's become its own celebration down there. But the Marinade and French Quarter, there are some people who never leave that section. And it's, I guess, Mardi Gras, it's most organic. You know, it just kind of happens. They don't have a parade permit to be anywhere or to do anything. It just happens.
You're stoked, aren't you? This is your time of year, big guy.
I can't wait, brother. On my way.
Real quick, King Cake, you like the traditional? You're the McKenzie's dry brioche type, aren't you? Or not?
That's me. That's me. Going back to when I was 12 years old, John Dobbert Elementary School, we had King Cake parties, and it was McKenzie's.
You better dunk that in some coffee. It's going to be hard going down. Thank you, Arthur. Have a good time
right,
today.
Tommy.
All right, we'll talk to you again soon. Arthur Hardy, founder of the Mardi Gras Guide, will take a break, come back, talk about keeping New Year's resolutions, which is going to be hard to do if you decided to diet, what with King's Day today. Tommy Tucker back in a flash, WWL. 9:28 on this Tuesday, January 6th, joined by our friend Dr. Judy Ho, a clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. Happy New Year, Dr. Judy Ho.
Happy New Year, Tommy. How's your New Year been so far?
So far, pretty good, but you know, it's still early. We got a long way to go. 360 Wait, I'm messing up here. 359, whatever it is. Today's King's Day here. You spent some time in New Orleans. You know what that is, right?
You know what? I don't.
That's when King Cake season begins.
King's Day.
King Cake season begins.
Oh.
I know you remember King Cakes, right?
King Cake. Well, I do remember King Cakes. That's really cool that you guys have a whole season for it. How did I miss this?
Well, come on back down and we'll reorient you. Let's talk about, because we talk about mental health here. We're very concerned about that. That's why you're on every other Tuesday. Let's talk about signs of depression as opposed to the post-holiday letdown. I was kidding around on Sunday afternoon texting some people saying, well, now I'm ready for the holidays. Unfortunately, is it normal
right.
for people to have a letdown after the holidays?
Oh, totally. I feel like first of all, it's so funny because I just made a reel about this on Instagram yesterday about like what we think depression is and what it actually is and how it doesn't always look that way where people just are sad. You know, it can look like a lot of other things. And I think that sometimes, especially around this time in the new year, there's a little bit of that, oh man, the holiday season's passed me by and now I got to wait a whole year for it. Or maybe you were expecting something huge to happen during the holiday and it kind of feels like a letdown because it just wasn't your expectations. You're going to feel that way for a little bit. I think that that's pretty normal. That's not depression if it's just a few days. And, you know, if you find yourself looking forward to things, still having joy, you know, in certain moments, then it's not depression. But depression is more something that kind of sticks with you. It's not just seasonal, but it's just not always sadness either. You know, sometimes it's just irritability and being snappy, especially with the people closest to you. Other times it's just, you know, the things that you used to love doing. It's not that you don't like them at all anymore. It's just it's not getting you that same kick that it used to. Or it's not being able to focus and concentrate and really move forward with your goals. People sometimes think, oh, maybe that's because I have ADHD. Maybe, but it could also just be a telltale symptom of depression.
You know, as you say that, I'm thinking if you get to the holidays being a diversion and I got to wait a whole year for them to come around again, if you go to substance abuse, it's all about really escaping reality or the humdrum everyday existence, right? That's what it seems to me is what we're talking about here, ultimately.
Exactly. I mean, I think that all of us need a little bit of escapism. Sure, that makes sense. You know, when you're an adult, you've got lots of responsibilities, so you're looking forward to the weekend, you're looking forward to that next getaway. That's all normal. But when you're leaning way too much into avoidance or escapist coping, where, for example, you're just playing video games for 8 hours a day, almost every day, or you find yourself just kind of laying on a couch whenever you have a free time just to try to sleep your day away. That's something that also people don't talk about that much, that sometimes that's what depression can look like. That's what escaping life can look like, where you're just basically like, well, if I just go to sleep and just lay here, then I don't have to deal with any of my problems. And of course, alcohol and substances are a big part of that escapism too, because again, you alter your reality for a specific moment in time. And when people don't love their reality, they're going to go to that more and more as a coping.
So when it comes to, and I hate to use the word normal, to love every moment of every day, something's wrong with you, brah. Because that's not normal, is it? I mean, and it goes to escapism, Dr. Judy. No, you understand what I'm saying? Because it seems like that's not the way we're wired, is it?
No, I think that's why people expect that you're supposed to feel that way. And I think reality TV, social media, it can make us feel like that's how some people live. And we've talked about this before, Tommy, but, you know, most people share their highlight reels, right? Mm-hmm. They're sharing the great things about what's happening in their life. And even when they appear to have a raw, real moment with you, you have to remember they're still putting that out there for the public to consume, right? So even their quote-unquote raw moments, I mean, how real is what they're sharing? I think it depends on person to person, but most of the times, it's still curated, right? So let's say somebody that you look up to shares that they are struggling with depression or anxiety, and you're thinking, okay, that's great, but mine is way worse than that. Well, you have to remember that they still put this piece out there, even if they're trying to be vulnerable and trying to be real, that's still curated. Mm-hmm. So it may not be what they're thinking moment to moment when they're really in the throes of their mental illness or their struggles or their grief or whatever it is that they might be dealing with. And so I think these unrealistic expectations actually cause us to be at more risk for true clinical depression and anxiety, because you're like, well, why doesn't my brain work that way? Why don't I feel that way about life? And life is full of ups and downs. Even the happiest person who is not clinically depressed, if you don't have ups and downs, you're lying. Right. You can be going through a great season in your life, but something will happen. That, you know, somebody will annoy you. Somebody will upset you.
That's what I meant earlier when I said, come on, brah, something's not real here because not everybody is happy all the time. It's just not the way life works.
No.
So along those lines, you have to kind of manage your expectations going into it. I mean, you look, when you're a baby, you don't go into life and they don't sit you down and say, okay, little Judy, here we go. When you go, and explain the way life's going to be to you. But at some point, you do have to sit down and have a conversation with yourself about managing your expectations and what can you reasonably expect out of life. Do you not?
Absolutely. And I think that, again, you know, living a good life, a valued life, a life that you're proud of, that's not going to feel great all the time. Mm-hmm. Because when you're living true to yourself and you're saying, well, I'm not going to sweep things under the rug and I actually am here to get better as a human being and have good relationships, you're going to have conflict. You're going to have troubles. If you're reaching for a goal, you're going to have struggles. You're going to have self-doubt, right? Overcoming any kind of adversity requires you to be willing to experience at least some negative emotion on the way there. Mm. And so I think if you want your life to be meaningful and to look back and say, I'm so glad that I did that, even if I didn't make it, or even if it looked like a failure, or even if I made mistakes, you're not going to be happy all the time. And unfortunately, I think that that's what people are selling these days, whether it's, you know, certain types of celebrities, influencers, life coaches are like, oh, like, things should be positive all the time. You should always be living your dream life. You should love every moment of your job. How can someone love every single moment of their job? It's called a job for a reason, right? But I think that these people, while they might be well-meaning, are putting a message out there that actually causes people to feel really inferior about themselves. And that is, I think, my problem with overly positive mantras and what we call now toxic positivity, right? Because when someone's like, just cheer up, be happy, that ironically makes you feel even worse about yourself and your life.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up with toxic positivity when we come back. We're talking to Dr. Judy Ho, clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. Somebody texted in, and this is interesting, talking about escapism. My significant other had an affair, but I don't think it was about love or sex. I think it was about escapism because they hated their job. You can delve into that, Dr. Judy Ho. When we come back, clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast, 9:36, 24 till 10, traffic now, WWL. It is 9:42, 18 till 10. We're talking to Dr. Judy Ho, our friend, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast, and we're talking about toxic positivity. A little bit more on that, Dr. Judy, before we get to the text.
Yeah, I think that toxic positivity is something that's affected a lot of people because they're actually trying to feel better, get better, recover from depression, stop being a negative person. But this idea of toxic positivity means that no matter what the circumstances, no matter what moment of the day, you're telling yourself you're supposed to just be happy and not have any negative emotions. And if you do, that's bad. And we've already talked about, you know, how generally living life, you're not going to be positive all the time. But also, remember, your negative emotions are functional. They're telling you a story. They're telling you something to pay attention to. It's a survival mechanism. So you wouldn't want to dull that, right? You want to be able to tap into your emotions, and it doesn't mean that it feels comfortable in the moment, but those negative emotions are telling you something, and there's something to be learned from them.
I'm going to tattle on myself here. As a younger person, I can remember telling somebody who was feeling down, what are you down about? You got two legs, you got two arms, you can walk, you can talk, you can see, you got all of this going for you. When in fact, that is of little comfort, and that was the worst thing I could have said. Accurate?
I don't know if it's the worst thing, but I appreciate you sharing that. I mean, I think that I feel like you're not the only one, though. So mm-hmm. It's good that you shared that, because that would not be the only reaction that Tommy has. It's what everybody does from moment to moment, mm-hmm. I think.
So a more appropriate response would have been, well, what is it that's got you sad? What is it that's got you down, maybe?
Yeah, like maybe be more curious about it. And I know that that's not going to be doable every single time. That's why the 80-20 rule applies, you know. Mm-hmm. I still beat myself up all the time when I make a mistake, do something wrong. I can be very mean to myself in my head. And sometimes it's just like, okay, you know what? Without all of that, let's just like remove all of that. You know, what is there anything to be learned here? Can you just sit with this and know that this mm-hmm. is temporary and it's not going to last forever? I think that that's important for all of us to try to do. Maybe 80% of the time would be a more realistic goal than having to do that 100% of the time.
So let's talk about the text that came in, which is basically, and it's long and disjuncted as some of these texts can be, because people text in just to let the audience know, and then other people text in, so your text gets interrupted by somebody else's text, then I got to go back and piece all of this together. But bottom line, basically, they're saying that somebody was involved in an affair, but they didn't think the affair had anything to do with sex or love or passion. It was because the other person was so miserable in their job, they were looking for an outlet and they were looking for any diversion. Is there any case to be made for that or not?
Well, that could be one part of why they had an affair. It's fine if you want to find a reason. But unless you guys are completely cool with having an open relationship and that was agreed upon beforehand, they still violated your trust and violated a covenant or an agreement that you made when you got into this relationship. So explaining it is one thing. And then the other thing is, you know, well, are you okay with this violation? And if you're not, can this be recoverable, right? Do you want to save this relationship? But if you want to save this relationship, the person who was cheated on, they have to be honest with themselves and with the other person in terms of how this felt, what they wanted, right? It could be one reason you can say, well, someone's having a midlife crisis or someone's going through something. They're dealing with a lot of grief, a lot of stress, and that's why they cheated. I'm not sure if that's a valid reason to explain away the entire behavior, because it was a very deliberate act, right, mm-hmm. That they still did. So you need to have this conversation, and the next time they're struggling with something, whatever it is, whether it's stress at work or something else, are you going to fear that they're going to do it again, you know, and is there any recourse? So I think while important to try to figure out what some of the underlying reasons are, you also do sometimes have to focus on the behavior and what it means for your relationship.
Yeah, not to lighten up this or anything, but, you know, you'd hate to come home and find somebody else there. You had another bad day at work, huh, honey? So when it comes to fixing that trust, somebody else texted in, once that trust has been violated and you have been cheated upon, can it be rectified? Can it be fixed? Can you repair that relationship?
I think it's possible for some relationships and for some people. Every situation is different, and you can't judge one relationship for another. So sometimes people will say, well, if I ever found myself in that situation, I'd get out right away. Well, maybe, you know, but when you're actually in a situation, there's a lot to think about. There's the practicalities, there's the family that you've built together, there's the relationship that you've had for years and years without major problems, or so you thought, right? So I think that the first step is true communication really being 100% brutally honest with one another about what it is that you need and why this happened, and whether or not both people are really committed to making this relationship work in the future. So if you are the person who was cheated on, you cannot hold this betrayal, this affair over their head for the rest of your lives, right? So are you the bigger person enough so that you can actually not forget, but truly forgive and not keep bringing it up in future arguments, you know, or somehow think that this means that you have a free-for-all and you get to go cheat too and that they shouldn't be mad about it. I mean, you really have to know whether or not you're that kind of person who can let this go truly and try to have essentially a do-over. You do have to have a sense of a do-over. You can't just be tracking where they're going all the time, putting tabs on them, calling them every time they don't call you every 30 minutes. You know, that's not going to make a relationship work. So if you can't reestablish the trust and you can't even do it, even if you invite a professional to help you, go to couples counseling, you know, pray, whatever it is that you need to do, sometimes it is better to separate and to just have a think on it before you make a final decision about the relationship.
I would think, and I'm no Dr. Judy Ho, but I would think the first step is you got to go back and you got to do some undigging, excavating, if you will, and figure out what was it that led to the infidelity to begin with, right, before you can address it?
Yeah, that's a great point. And Tommy, I think that this is also where people are not honest, right? They're not being honest with one another. They're saying, I really do care about you. I do love you. But at the same time, I'm not really willing to tell you the truth about why I did what I did. You know, maybe I'm trying to protect you. Maybe I'm trying to take care of something in some specific way in my mind. And I'm being selfish. I'm not really thinking about the longevity of this relationship. So I think you want to be careful when you have that conversation. It doesn't slip into just excuse making, like, well, I did this because this, and you weren't paying attention to me. You know, those are excuses. Those are not really the reasons why you cheated.
So apparently the text line is going crazy here. I don't know if it's been a cheating holiday season or whatever's going on here, but I'm getting a lot of texts about this. Somebody wants to know if the other person is not going to let it go, then you need to separate, because if, as you said, Dr. Judy, you can always be bringing it up or holding it over the other person's head. That's not a situation that's sustainable, is it?
No, it's really not. And I think that, again, you have to expect some of that. If you're the person who was a cheater, you have to expect that there were, going to be some feelings, at least in the beginning. So you're going to have to let them get out their aggressions, their passive aggressiveness. They're going to make comments. But, you know, after the first, I would say, a few months, that should no longer be the color of all of your arguments. And if it is, maybe you guys need to take a break and think about whether or not you can really start over and trust a person again, because it's too hard to live with all of that resentment. And if you don't truly trust the person, then you really have nothing in that partnership.
And another text comes in and says they think their former partner was basically incapable of fidelity or monogamy. So are some people wired that way, or does that indicate and I know this is general, you don't know the people involved here, Dr. Judy, but are some people wired that way, or does that indicate a deeper problem? Does monogamy go against the human nature, or do we know this?
I mean, I think that for a lot of people who say that, you know, they're just not wired for monogamy, there could be some biological inclinations for why you say that or why you think that is. And you can make all the arguments that you want. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, monogamy is a choice, right? It is a choice, because we have free will and we have a brain that we can think with, and, you know, we direct our actions. And you can say that monogamy is not for you. If it's not, then don't be in a monogamous relationship. You know, go be in an open relationship, or don't be in any relationship. It's not fair for you to get into a committed monogamous relationship and then say you're not built for monogamy, right? So that's your choice. Right. So I'm not going to make any comments on people's ideas and lifestyle choices about what partnership means. But it's more about, you know, that's also not an excuse. Right. Once you decide to get into a monogamous relationship, then you, even if you're, nobody's built for it in the long run in the same way. Like, relationships, as if they last long enough, are going to have conflict. There's going to be times when you don't feel like you're in love with the person. Maybe you feel more like you're a roommate with them. Those are all not good excuses to all of a sudden say, well, monogamy is not for me. And living with anybody for long periods of time and being in committed relationships with anybody is a choice, and a hard choice that you make every single day, no matter whether or not you think that you're built for monogamy or not. So I think that, you know, we have to really just think about what it really means when you say that you want to be in a relationship and a committed one, and know, again, like we were talking about before, toxic positivity. You need to be in love with that person every single moment of every day. No, you're not going to be.
No, you got to respect them, no, huh? Dr. Judy, thank you so much. I appreciate your time and your insight. As always, Dr. Judy Ho, clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks, or, as it equates, about 20 king cakes from now. Back in a flash, we'll find out what Newell's got planned for us on WWL.